Welcome to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips, a color-conscious podcast about politics. I'm your host, Steve Phillips, and 36 years ago next week, I experienced one of the most exciting political and social change moments of my life. It was the 1988 Democratic presidential primary. And on that March day, Michigan held its primary election. Candidates included Congressman Richard Gephardt, Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, and civil rights leader Reverend Jesse Jackson. And that night, Jackson shocked the establishment by winning Michigan and actually moving into first place in the presidential contest. I'll never forget that moment when it was called for Jesse. We all erupted in cheers. So Jesse won that contest by assembling a coalition of African Americans, progressives, and labor. And also, there's a large Arab population in Michigan. And all of that came together to propel him, and he was one of the few leaders unafraid to embrace the Arab people and call for justice and peace in the Middle East. Today, Michigan is again front and center in national politics. The same large Arab population and its allies are anguished and outraged at what is happening in Gaza and the Middle East. And in this year's primary, a large segment of the state's voters cast a powerful protest vote by voting uncommitted instead of backing President Biden. 100,000 people voted uncommitted. So Michigan could be pivotal and decisive in the general election. The last few elections were decided by razor-thin margins, and 100,000 votes could easily be the margin of difference. To help us understand what's happening on the ground in Michigan and what it means in 2024, we're joined by an old friend of mine and a trailblazing leader in modern journalism. And speaking of writing, I also want to thank everyone who helped with the book launch last week for How We Win Civil War's second edition, the paperback edition. It went very well, and we were able to talk to dozens of radio hosts across the country and engage with thousands of activists and organizers. It was a very meaningful experience. We're very, very grateful for all the help that we received. And so with that, let's get to today's episode. Hi, Charlene. How are you? Thank you for your help with the launch. And do you want to introduce our guest?
Hi, Steve. I can't wait to introduce our guest. I just wanted to quickly also just chime in and just thank so many of our listeners and followers for all of their support during our book launch of the second edition of How We Win. Couldn't have done it without you. And one of my highlights, I have to say, Steve, is you were on MSNBC with Jonathan Capehart, which was in of itself already just a win and just such a great cherry on top for ending launch week. And not only that, but for those of you who might know, there's this handle on Twitter, this account called Room Raider that rates guests on TV who get interviewed from their homes. And then they rate sort of the background of whatever room they're in their home. And Steve got rated 10 out of 10. And it was just really fun to see Room Raider rate Steve. And thankfully we got it.
Well, to pull the curtain back for the listeners, both, I was on Capehart's show because Charlene stalked him and tracked him down. Do you have a cell phone? Can you get him? Can we get it? And I was like, I don't think it's going to happen, Charlene. Let's see, I know I'm on national television with Jonathan. And that Charlene had spent 3 hours up in the attic a few years ago. Mm-hmm. She said, can I tidy up in your attic? And I'm all like, she's still up there rearranging things and blah, blah, blah. And so you are largely responsible for getting it into shape.
I channeled my inner Marie Kondo. Was actually much more satisfying to clean your attic than to deal with my own house and clutter. So that's just the way it goes, right? But anyway, it was made it for an extra fun week. And again, thanks so much, everyone. And also for our listeners, just real quick reminder, if you're listening, if you could take a few seconds today, we'd love to ask you to remember to leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. It really makes a difference for other new listeners looking for new podcasts to hear, to see ratings. So thanks so much in advance. Okay. And with that, I'm so excited to tell everyone about our guest today. Our guest today is Sarah Alvarez. Sarah is the founder of Outlier Media, which is a Detroit-based service journalism organization that delivers data reporting and valuable information to low-income news consumers over SMS and message apps. She is a former lawyer and public radio reporter at Michigan Radio and was a 2015 John S. Knight Journalism Fellow at Stanford University. Her work has been featured on NPR, Marketplace, the Center for Investigative Reporting, Bridge Magazine, The Detroit News, and The New York Times. Sarah, welcome. We're so thrilled to have you here today.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining. And we left off of your bio the things where we had actually connected. So there was, Sarah used to work with the organization Young People 4, which found and developed young leaders across the country. This was like, I think 20 years ago, actually. And then in terms of this whole presidential piece, right, Sarah came to help, in terms of bringing order to things, Charlene, helped to organize our fundraising effort around our work for the Obama Super PAC in 2008, kind of impose some order and discipline on that effort and whatnot, before she went off to transform Michigan in journalism. So thanks so much for being with us. So we wanted to start with what we were talking about at the intro about the Michigan primary in terms of what's happening there on the ground. There's 101,000 Democrats, about 13% voted uncommitted. Then after that, Super Tuesday, another 263,000 people voted uncommitted. And again, this effort's mainly led from what our understanding is from a lot of young Arab and Muslim organizers who are talking about bringing their agenda to the Democratic Convention. So just what are you seeing and hearing, and what's your kind of analysis and assessment of how voters, and particularly progressive, and particularly Arabs and those who care about peace in the Middle East, are looking at the presidential election and at the president?
Yeah, so a couple things. While we did work together in 2008, and then I, not too long after that, made a hard pivot into journalism. Mm. And so since then, I have not been involved in politics unless I'm covering politics. Mm. And we at Outlier don't do that much political coverage. And there's a couple of reasons for that, which I feel like are important to talk about. I think that political coverage in particular can be low value for news consumers. And what we really want to do is bring very high value, actionable information. And I think that that ties in to what's happening with the primary, because both journalism and politics seem to have a similar problem right now, and that they are not responsive to people. And I think that this is what we're seeing with this uncommitted vote, is that yes, it is a protest for a particular policy by the Biden administration and a particular set of actions. I also think that it is a protest vote about a lack of responsiveness from elected leaders to the residents and citizens of Michigan. And I also think that journalism and politics are similar, before I get right into the uncommitted vote, I think that they are also similar in that both industries tend to blame people, not themselves. So this uncommitted vote is seen as like, what is wrong with voters that they don't understand the stakes of this election and they're not getting on board the Democrats, rather than what is the problem here with this campaign or with this set of choices or whatever. That is not the dialogue that we are hearing. There is not a "the customer is always right" kind of mentality in politics nor in journalism. And I think that's strange in politics, especially because people do have the opportunity to actually vote. And with the uncommitted vote, yes, there was a campaign here to get 10,000 people to vote uncommitted. And that effort was 10 times as successful as organizers expected.
Wow.
Which tells me that this is a phenomenon that we don't fully understand. And I think questioning it and wanting to ask more questions about it is good. I think that we should be careful to draw too many conclusions, given that organizers themselves were very surprised. There's always been a group of people who have voted uncommitted in primaries here in the state. But in 2012, which was kind of the last time that we can really compare to this year, it was about 11% of people voted uncommitted in that election, but that was only 20,000 people. So this is, you know, not very different in terms of a percentage. We have 13% now, but it's very different in terms of the amount of people who felt like they wanted to come out and vote. And the other thing I'll say about this election is that Michigan has made voting more accessible in the last few years, which is wonderful. And now people can vote early and vote from home much more easily, vote absentee. So most voters in this primary voted early and voted absentee. And the only reason I bring that up is because the organizing for the Uncommitted campaign was very close to the election, and many people, the majority of people who voted, had already voted in the election by that time.
So can you say a little bit about what you're just hearing from people, both in your journalistic capacity and just kind of being in Michigan? It's like, how has the attitude and feeling and reactions been towards, well, I guess the administration and president in general, and then in particular since the situation in the Middle East escalated?
What I'm hearing is, I don't think, very different from other places, in that there is a lack of energy and there is a real sense that politicians are not listening and that there are a lack of good choices. That is something that we are hearing. Michigan in 2022 had among the largest youth turnouts in the country. I would be very surprised if that can be replicated in this election. I have not, it's only March. However, I have seen very little organizing. I have seen very little prominent campaign activity. President Biden has visited the state a few times and has had surrogates visit the state, but it's very low energy. One of my primary concerns, and again, I think this dovetails with journalism, and I don't think that these are unrelated occurrences. Political campaigns are talking to a shrinking group of people. That is similar to the news media that is talking to a shrinking group of people, right? The audience is getting smaller and smaller. Turnout in Michigan is poor. Turnout in Wayne County is poor. That's the county that houses Detroit. Turnout in Detroit, which is the state's, you know, largest and blackest city, is poor. I have not seen real efforts to understand that lack of political engagement. And I have not seen genuine efforts to change that lack of political engagement. You will see, you know, get out the vote campaigns, which is very different than like a campaign to really invigorate political and civic participation, which I have not seen for years.
Yeah. Part of the untold backstory of that Jesse winning in 88 is, as you say, Michigan has been often on the forefront of making it easier to vote. And so they had same day voter registration. And so what Jesse did is he went to the public housing projects on election day, and he's all like, y'all, let's go vote. And just, they did little marches down to the polls, and that's how they generated the enthusiasm and the turnout.
That is really interesting. I did see enthusiasm around the uncommitted vote. It was an option. It was a reason for people to, it was a topic of conversation, right? It was a reason for people to actually go in person to the polls. And that was interesting to see, and in stark contrast to, I think, what we've heard a lot of conversation about, which is this lack of energy, this lack of option.
Yeah, it's something to pay attention to, that the energy is around an uncommitted vote. Do you think the Democrats and President Biden should be worried about his performance in Michigan's general election based on what we just saw in the primary results?
I think we all need to be worried about such a small group of people voting. That, I think, is really what troubles me, because we have a fragile democracy. And if we're seeing a lot of people opt out of it already, when it's so on the precipice, I think that that is really troubling. And I don't know, do so few people think that democracy is worth showing up for, worth saving? What is the reason that people are not going to the polls when it is such a consequential election? I do think we should worry about that, not just because of what's happening this year, but what's happened in the past. You know, Detroit typically has, you know, we don't break 30%, and we're much closer to 20%. In local elections, we're less than that. That's concerning for a place where civic life is so vibrant, that people are opting out of the political system on purpose. I don't think that this is an access issue. I think that this is a choice.
I want to dive a little bit more into Michigan's political dynamics and also look at what happened in 2020, right? Because it's been so closely fought, right? So there was, and I talked in my first book about how in 2016, Trump won, but everyone was assuming that there was all this big swing to Republicans when it's not happened at all, that the Democratic vote dropped, the floor dropped out. People went and voted for Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. And so that's what actually enabled Trump to win both Michigan and Wisconsin. And then it was close again in 2020, right? Biden won by just 2.8 percentage points. And then you had that massive post-election insurrection, counter-revolution in terms of that went on from, you know, election night all the way up, well, today, frankly, but certainly through January 6th. And so Michigan was a big focal point of them trying to flip those results, put pressure on the election counter. So I'm interested in what that was like, what you experienced at that time and what you observed. And then do you have any opinions or thoughts about how, if it's close again, what's that going to be like in terms of a post-election fight to protect the results?
So here in Detroit in 2020, I do wish that Candace Fortman, who's Outlier's executive director, and she's traveling for work today, so she's not able to be here with us, but she was volunteering down at the convention center where the votes were being counted and where there were protests, quote unquote, which was really just intimidation by right-wing and Republican Trump supporters. So that was really concerning. What has been encouraging is that despite organizing that is really trying to weaken the Democratic institutions that certify votes, that Michigan has been able to really be fairly strong. And I do feel that people can be really confident in their vote being counted. I do wonder if that's another reason why people vote early, because they're seeking to avoid some drama at the polls, if not outright intimidation. So we are keeping an eye on the city in particular and making sure that there are not attempts to intimidate voters during this election. I am not a, you know, Republican politics watcher, but no one can miss the fact that the Republican Party in Michigan is in disarray. There have been a lot of kind of personnel scandals, personality conflicts, very much a sideshow atmosphere. So I do think that that contributes to a perception that politics is very messy and off kilter, but I do think that kind of like behind the scenes, officials are working to make sure that this vote goes smoothly. But the rhetoric around the vote in 2020 was really alarming, and I don't expect to see anything different this time around.
So, Sarah, I want to talk about demographics in Michigan. Michigan is, what I've discovered is, through doing some research, is it's actually more racially diverse a state than most people realize. I mean, it is still 74% white, but it's getting more diverse every year. And demographic-wise, as of 2020, for example, there are over 200,000 registered voters in Michigan who identified as Muslim, over 300,000 people in Michigan identifying as Middle Eastern or North African. And again, that's from the most recent data from the U.S. Census. And in Saginaw, Michigan, which is a 44,000 person city, Black people make up 46% of that city's residents. And in Saginaw County, which is the only Michigan county to have voted for the winning presidential candidate in the last four elections, it has now become the go-to destination for anyone looking to understand which way the state might swing. President Biden, just to kind of give a sense of how that Saginaw is used as a barometer, if you will, just apparently made his second visit in 6 weeks to Saginaw earlier this month. So I wanted to ask you, how has Michigan's demographic makeup impacted which way the state votes?
I don't know that the demographic reality of Michigan is mirrored in the voting population. I do want to continue to beat the drum that our big problem is that too few people are turning out in every election, and that we are reading like we're really trying to kind of read tea leaves from a shrinking group, a shrinking cup of tea, right? And we're missing these bigger signals in the state at large, because I think that it is just as problematic if people go and vote for a candidate that is anti-democracy than if many people stand on the sidelines while this is being decided. I think that that is extremely problematic. And I think that the link to demographics is that Michigan, like many states across the country, we are seeing more people who have been historically undervalued as residents and as voters make up an increasing share of the population. So it would make sense to me, although I'm not a political scientist and I don't actually have this data, it would make sense to me that those people feel less engaged, feel less welcome. And I am not seeing campaigns to not just to get these people to turn out to vote, but to understand what these people's priorities are, what their wants are, and to make sure that people in office will be responsive to those concerns and those desires.
So I wanted to dig in a little bit more about the mind, I guess, of Michigan voters, as well as the issue around voter mobilization and then swing voters, right? So, you know, our core analysis, from what I've been trying to put out in the world, is that we're not doing enough in terms of understanding the changing demographic composition. We're not doing enough to mobilize voter turnout of those populations. Yet Michigan in particular has been kind of the, I don't know if epicenter, but like the poster child of swing voters, right? So Stan Greenberg, who was a Democratic pollster. So when Obama, this is a county, Macomb County. And so that had been like seen as the bellwether county. And then so Stan is kind of hilarious to me. So when Obama won, Stan got religion around, you know, the new American majority and diversity. And he wrote this piece in the New York Times saying, I'm done worrying about Macomb County in Michigan. But then when Trump won, he lost his religion. And so he was back to all worrying about, you know, Macomb, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just, well, that's my first question is about what's your sense of how much voters do swing back and forth? Because we're, you know, I've actually seen a lot of sort of lift up from the data saying that the percentage of voters in the country, period, who are swing voters is very, very small now. But I'm curious what the mind of the people in Michigan that you see and interact with.
I'm glad you ask. I think that this is one of those things where there is an outsized media narrative, largely, and the contributor to that narrative is the fact that so much media is nationalized, and we see very a diminished local news ecosystem. Try to think about who is a person in reality who is really swinging between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. This is insanity on just that's a basic
good point.
You do not need to be a journalist to be like, I cannot imagine who that person would be. I am sure that there are people who feel that way, who are that extreme, where these two people feel like some choices you can go back and forth between.
Equivalent.
Right? But like, that's going to be a small group of people because these choices are extreme. And so, you know, there is swings when people are less extreme, when they're promising the same thing, when you can't tell the difference. But to still be talking about a swing voter when these are extremes is ridiculous. It's not that I don't think that that person exists. I think that there is a desire from national media to find that person because that is a story that could potentially be interesting to the nation. When what we really need to be focusing in on is like, what do voters in Detroit really want? And for news organizations that cover Macomb County, what do voters in Macomb County really want? And how are they feeling about this election? But, you know, there's been a lot of work. There's something called, you know, the Citizens Agenda. There is a scholar at New York University named Jay Rosen, who does a lot of work around kind of like horse race coverage and putting things in opposition that shouldn't really be in opposition. And I think that it's just such a habit for news media to want to tell a story about a choice between these two candidates that every single person is making, rather than a story that is real, which is about a group, a country that is very divided and that has already made its choice, and a huge group of people that are sitting on the sidelines and feeling disinvested in this very, very important choice.
Yes, well, we're going to. So you've made the argument around why voices and journalistic entities such as yours need to be, because this, what you just articulated, is not the dominant, you know, narrative in politics. I want to get to that in 1 second. But just in terms of this whole, not exactly, well, yes, the horse race. And so your governor, Whitmer, there's been this buzz about her within Democratic circles for a number of years in terms of like, oh, presidential, should she be vice president, you know, that came out in 2020, et cetera. And I had never actually met her in person until I was invited to this meeting, which was ostensibly about like stopping DeSantis. This was like 2 or 3 years ago. And then I go to this meeting, and it's like a number of major donors and Governor Whitmer. And then I was like, oh, this is a Whitmer presidential meeting. That's what this is really about in terms of laying the groundwork and whatnot. And then also we should know and give a shout out that we have to, well, I mean, a friend and colleague and prior podcast guest was Garland Gilchrist in terms of the your lieutenant governor. So I mean, I am curious in terms of like what the perception is in state of the governor in terms of her, you know, leadership and her enthusiasm about her, et cetera.
Well, here in Detroit, I think that the governor is favorably viewed. Detroit is a predominantly Democratic city, even though we do have low voter turnout. So I think that she is viewed favorably. The conversation around will she have a role in national politics is not one that people are particularly interested in here. People are interested in what are people doing for me today? What are my city leaders doing for me? What are state leaders doing for me? And I don't see a lot of interest in that conversation amongst Detroiters.
Interesting. It's great to hear you talk about how you and, you know, those in your organization are in touch with what you know, people are saying, and that you're able to hear what people are saying. And it's just a great reminder that there's this gap, a sort of out of touchness between the systems that be and then what people really want on a day-to-day basis, families, working people. I wanted to end by talking a little bit more about your media outlet. We've seen all of us, and, you know, Steve and I talk about how we used to be also journalists and worked in journalism, that in general, there's this failure within the for-profit journalism model, even including these legacy sort of massive corporations, and that we're also seeing a growing trend in nonprofit journalism. And you founded Outlier Media in 2016 as a substantial, you've had a substantial amount of time to grow it and learn from it. And it's a service journalism organization, which I think maybe a lot of listeners don't actually know what that means. So what I wanted to first ask you is, what does it mean to be a nonprofit journalism organization? What does service journalism mean? And how does that, what's the role that that type of organization will play as a newsroom and how news gets reported going forward?
So let's go back to our conversation about Governor Whitmer and whether or not she's interested in a presidential run or whether or not people are interested in her running for president.
Yeah, she's definitely interested. The question is, are the people interested?
Are people interested? Having a national, a media landscape that is dominated by national players makes that conversation very important. Mm-hmm. And then the metrics by which we begin to judge Governor Whitmer change. The metric then becomes, is she a good presidential candidate? When really people here have other questions for her and they have different accountability metrics that they would like seen, they would like met. So it is the role of local journalism to be responsive to those accountability gaps. And service journalism, all we mean by that is that we exist to serve the people of Detroit, and that our job is to close information gaps, accountability gaps, and connection gaps for Detroiters. We are not led by a profit motive. We have to break even if we want to exist, but we are not trying to make money. And so our decision-making, our business model is not dependent on what advertisers might want or how we are perceived by anybody other than our audience. The reason why I think that this, even though I, again, I'm a local editor and my wheelhouse is housing and utilities and accountability gaps in Detroit, not really national politics. But the reason why I feel comfortable having this conversation, like I said, is because we are seeing the same trends in news as we are seeing in politics. And that is just this chronic and unconscionable undervaluing of such a huge number of people. News media that is, some of it that is nonprofit, but also the ones that have a business motive, have long prioritized wealthier people and whiter people because the advertising model prioritized those folks. In a move to membership or to subscriptions, that didn't change that dynamic. It still encouraged newsrooms to kind of go after people who have money because they were seen as the people who could support the newsroom. And that really led to a total lack of curiosity on newsrooms' part about who else had needs to be met and who else had accountability gaps and information gaps that were worth attending to. This is the same problem in politics because politics is so money driven that there is too much focus on what rich people want. And until it comes time to pay the bills, there's not a lot of interest in what small donors might be able to do, or in the case of news, like regular residents who need information. But I do think that, you know, when I started Outlier, people did not really think of news as filling information gaps. That wasn't really seen as something that news should do. News was about stories. News was about giving people something to talk about or feeling like, you know, informed, but not really like, how do I get the information I need to meet my challenges, to achieve my goals? And COVID really changed that. I think that if we think back to, unfortunately, 4 years ago, right? Like just now, basically at this exact time 4 years ago, mm-hmm. everybody started to understand what it felt like to be inside of an information gap. We saw how destructive that was. We saw how stressful that was. We saw how misinformation breeds in that environment and how people disconnect from each other in that environment. And that is what many communities are dealing with all the time around different issues, around housing, around utilities, around incarceration, right? Like there are these kind of levels of crisis all across the country. And I do think that it is newsrooms' job to attend to those people and to those communities and to those gaps. And I think it is public servants' job to attend to those things. One of my great pleasures in this job is housing the Detroit Documenters Network. And so as much as kind of as like as concerned as I am for democracy and for this upcoming election, I do think that there are some really amazing bright spots. There's a program, if people are not familiar with it, called the Documenters Network. There are 15 sites around the country. It's a program that started in Chicago, and Detroit is the second location that Documenters started in. And what Documenters does is it trains people and pays people to go to city and county meetings and take notes. Those notes get edited by a collaborative of seven newsrooms around the city. We run the collaborative, but it's got commercial television. It has the Detroit Free Press. It has alternative press. Like we are all in as a ecosystem on this project. And so those notes are edited and then they go online and they create a record, but they also increase accountability on their own. When regular residents show up to meetings across the city regularly, it completely changes the behavior of elected officials. It makes them more human. It makes them more responsive. it changes the way that journalists act, which is oftentimes in these meetings to like be like, okay, well, we know this person, they're on, you know, they're always crazy, they're always saying crazy things, and we kind of ignore it as journalists who cover this all the time. Send a documenter in there and they will be like, what is happening? Why is this person acting this way? And how is that acceptable, right? This is a public servant. Aren't they supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z? And it makes all of us question, like, you're right. What it, like, maybe this does need more sunlight. Maybe this is something we should all talk about. And it's a beautiful community of practice. We have 500 Detroit documenters, which is pretty incredible.
That's incredible.
It's wonderful. They range in age from 16 to 80. They come from all walks of life, but it is like very representative of Detroit and Detroiters. And they do special assignments. We have documenters who ride the bus every year as part of a project to make sure that public transportation is working the way that it should. Our public transportation system in Detroit is abysmal and not enough people ride it. So we have documenters getting on to make sure that people are, that the officials are delivering on the promises. We have documenters covering juvenile justice hearings that are so important, and these children's lives are so impacted, and those are not public, but we have made a deal with the judge that will allow us to cover them if we redact all the names, and that helps investigative reporting by the Detroit Free Press. So there are ways to get people civically engaged and civically involved, but I do think it takes that kind of effort. It's not enough to say, go vote. Do your duty and go vote for this person who we've decided is the right person. Mm-hmm. It's really like help shape a better community together. And people will join in if it's worth their while.
Yeah, I wanted to just quickly dive into that a little bit more, because I heard a little bit about this documenter's concept from the nonprofit journalism people in Cleveland, because they're starting an effort there. And I was just in Texas a couple of weeks ago, and they were talking there about how the right wing has basically a documenters of their own, where they will send people like to all these things. So it's a very large thing to do at scale, and it really kind of hounds the progressive elected officials like they did after, you know, Lena Hidalgo in Harris County. And as somebody who was in local government, right? I was on the school board in San Francisco. It was like having somebody show up. There's a guy, Neil Gendel, who was the clean water guy. And he would show up and be like, oh, here's Neil. We got to pay attention to this whole clean water issue, because he is like really bird dogging it. And then conversely, I remember when I went to Sacramento, the California state capitol, and I saw how little journalism was there, how few journalists. And I was like, people think they could probably think they'd get away with anything up here because nobody's watching. So it's quite a fascinating and exciting development, but I'm just curious you say a little bit more both about how you find the people, and then I'm also very curious as to what level of, I guess, frankly, philanthropic understanding and enthusiasm there's been for it.
We find people the old-fashioned way, right? It's very much an organizing effort, right? So we reach out in all the traditional ways that you would reach out if you were looking for people to get involved. But we pay people, and we pay people well, right? Like, we pay people $18 an hour to participate in this work. And that is a key component of it, right? This is not just volunteer. This is like, we value your time. This is an essential service, and we want to pay you for it. So we reach out in schools. We reach out in, you know, to senior centers, we reach out in events, but also the people who are documenters are amazing evangelists for it, because it really is inclusive. It really is an antidote to so much of what we see and feel, that there's like a lack of care, a lack of investment. That's simply not true. We have the data to show that it's not. I think that there is a lot of philanthropic interest in this, because it is so effective. We can cover the whole city and do these special projects in a way that we could never afford to do if we were a newsroom attempting it to do it on our own. But it's not just that. These are not citizen journalists. These are residents who want to contribute to a better civic infrastructure and a better civic life. So they're not trying to be reporters. They have their own goals. And we are very much in support of that. And I think because of that, the program has benefits far beyond the news ecosystem, right, and the information ecosystem. One thing that one of our documentaries coordinators, Linnell Herndon, said at the beginning of this program, she said that one of the benefits of documenters showing up to these meetings is that they understand that their elected officials are human and that they are working hard and that they are doing their best. And it creates a level of respect and kind of common purpose among residents and elected officials that is far too rare. It's beautiful. I mean, local news is not a space where you're like, this is beautiful. But
you're opening my, I'm so excited. I mean, as a journalist who started off, a young journalist covering meetings, I know exactly what you mean. And now for the first time, I'm feeling very hopeful about what journalism can be. And it's exciting. And because I don't think a lot of people know that this is happening. And I just hope it just keeps growing. That's amazing.
Yeah, me too. And I think what it requires is it requires newsrooms to be less scared and less invested in controlling their own narrative and keeping things close. And that's the same thing in politics. Like, if we want to do a good job representing our communities as newsrooms or even as political leaders, we really do need to throw open those doors and invite more people in a sincere way.
Well, we're going to need to wrap. We could go on, but how can people keep up with you and what your work is on like social media and whatnot?
Absolutely. They can go to outliermedia.org. That's the best place to find us.
And I just want to say on a personal, unprofessional note that, you know, we haven't been in touch in a number of years, and you talk about making your hard pivot and even just doing this conversation. Just kind of like the way you light up and talk about the work. It's, you know, it's very inspiring. It's really great to see. And it feels like you've really found your passion and you're really pursuing it. So it's just wonderful to see.
No, I so appreciate that. It's very true. And it is a hard pivot, but all of these systems are interconnected. And for too long, reporters have felt like they can close themselves off from politics, and it's our job to. But if that means disinvesting in our communities, that's not acceptable.
All right, that's all the time we have for today. I'm glad you got a chance to meet my friend Sarah Alvarez. It was really great to reconnect with her. Thank you for listening to Democracy in Color with Steve Phillips. Please help us get the word out about this podcast by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts, sharing with your friends, tweeting at Democracy in Color and at Steve P. Tweets, and finding us at Democracy in Color on Facebook or Instagram. You can also keep up with all things DEMCO by subscribing to our newsletter at democracyincolor.com. If you listen to our podcast on iTunes, please leave us a rating and a comment. It helps others to find our show. This podcast is a Democracy in Color production. Our producer is Olivia Parker. Fola Onifade is our staff writer and associate producer. Charlene Chang is our editor and co-host. Special thanks to April Elkier for Quality Check. Recorded virtually with the assistance of the podcast studio of San Francisco. Until next time, keep the faith.